Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. So welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas podcast. Today I have Michael Barnett as a very special guest. Michael's a university professor of international affairs and political science at the George Washington University. He's a former associate editor of International Organization, and Michael's very widely published on humanitarianism, on global governance. And in his research interests, he says that he's interested in the relationship between suffering and progress in the liberal international order. Michael, I'm very pleased to have you as a guest. How are you today?
Terrific. Good morning, good afternoon.
Good. So you're speaking from Washington?
No, actually, I'm speaking from the heartland of the United States, Champaign, Illinois.
Illinois.
It really is the heartland. It's about 2.5 hours south of Chicago.
Yeah. I was in Chicago. And I was in the, where was I there? In the Caterpillar plant. Where is that? That's quite close to you.
Peoria.
That's right, Peoria, yeah. So I got close, but big country there, big skies.
Yeah, flat country.
That's right. So Michael, I've been given a project to work on with the Save the Children, to think about how to develop leadership in the field for a new age of humanitarianism. And I was delighted to find your book, Empire of Humanity, where you talk about the ages of humanitarianism. And I'd like to explore that with you, really. What's held it together in the last couple of hundred years and what the future might look like? So could you say something just a bit about the kind of your book, The Empire of Humanity? Why do you use the word empire?
Yeah, well, what's important is that you bundle that with humanity as well.
Yeah,
because that's the way, you know, at least my thinking is on, you know, with respect to humanitarianism. The empire part is that you really can't understand humanitarianism unless you understand several things. One is that it did emerge in the context of colonialism and imperialism, at least with respect to the global South. Mm-hmm. So this is where the humanitarians follow the flag and follow the saber. And so, you know, there is that bundling. But more importantly, empire is also a form of power that operates without the consent of those who are the subjects or objects of that power. And that's very much, in my view, a cornerstone of a lot of humanitarianism, that, you know, you have individuals who want to give, mm-hmm. and they want to give because they see a need. And the needs are often presented by those who are victims as we have a need. The consequence, though, in terms of that gift relationship is that those who are providing the gifts often do so without any awareness of what the recipients need or how the recipients feel about the gift, or in more, you know, in terms of your own interest of leadership, is that you don't really have any kind of genuine partnership that goes along between givers and receivers. And there's a very heavy hand of paternalism, yeah. that, which I should say, is not necessarily a bad thing. When we think about paternalism a little more systematically, but there is a heavy hand of paternalism. At the same time, you know, and part of that paternalism is we want to do good for others. And we see ourselves acting in the name of humanity, and humanity conjures this idea of one community, a kind of cosmopolitanism and universalism in which we're all in it together, and oftentimes in forms of solidarity. And so here you have the juxtaposition of empire, which is power over, and then humanity, which suggests the absence of power, that we're all joined together in a form of egalitarianism. And so that becomes, if you will, the sort of organizing theme of the book, in which you constantly juxtapose the idea that there are givers who are largely relatively wealthy white Northerners, who want to do good for others, but do so in a fairly heavy-handed way. And there's that constant struggle between these two dimensions. But, you know, to understand humanitarianism, at least globally and historically for me, means moving that front and center and really wrestling with that relationship of equality and inequality.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's very interesting. I could see the paternalism coming right through the histories, the ages, as you set them out. There's the Christian paternalism, then there's a more liberal paternalism. But you looking, is humanitarian absolutely connected to kind of a liberal order in your mind? Is it part of kind of a universal liberal, post-enlightenment kind of way of thinking, or is it beyond that? Does it come go beyond that?
You know, and I think this is one of the interesting elements of humanitarianism when you think about it in relationship to liberalism. For many people, the two are very much connected. Mm-hmm. And so you did have liberal humanitarians or imperialists in Britain from the 19th century, like John Stuart Mill, and others who argue that if you're going to do colonialism and do it right, it has to have a moral face to it. And that means that you have responsibility to the subjects. It should not just be exploitative and extractive. And then, you know, so there's that tradition as well. There are the traditions of, again, turning to Britain and the United States now, of, you know, liberal activists and social welfare reformers, who in many ways, you know, like Eglantine Jebb, who you know from Save the Children, that was her background from a welfare, scientific welfare oriented Victorian England. And she brings that sensibility with her to Save the Children. So, you know, you find these interesting connections between liberalism and humanitarianism, and in many ways, the forms change over time because liberalism is not static. It changes. Mm-hmm. And so too does humanitarianism with it. But also more in some ways as fundamental is that humanitarianism also wants to see itself as outside any kind of dominant ideologies. That it is, because it's humanity, because it's about, you know, what is supposed to be outside of any political ideology, like liberalism, this is about saving lives.
Yeah.
And communists can save lives, Hindus can save lives, Jews can save lives, you know, Nigerians can save lives. And so that act of saving lives, of care, can be, if you will, post-ideological. Or pre-ideological, but it's separated. And I think that's actually a really important point to think about at this moment where, you know, there's the purported end of the liberal order. And so one of the questions that concerns many humanitarians is if, and I want to stress if humanitarianism is buffeted by liberalism and liberalism declines, then what happens to humanitarianism? And, you know, my sense is that humanitarianism is more anchored morally than is liberalism. But given the fact that a lot of humanitarianism has been supported by liberal states, when you look at the donors, whether it's OECD, or the US or them combined, you know, most of the donors are liberal democratic states, then, you know, what happens when, let's say, they become fatigued or they decide because of nationalist programs that we really don't need to care for those suffering others. We have enough at home to care about. Yeah. So I think those are some of the interesting concerns between liberalism and humanitarianism through the ages, but also in our contemporary moment.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I picked it up. I mean, for the listeners, it's probably important to kind of say the early humanitarians, there was a big shift. It was really one of the first times we started to care about the suffering other who was distant, wasn't it? It was quite a mindset shift. We perhaps take it for granted now that we think about kind of a famine in Africa, but that was quite a novel idea, wasn't it? That we actually cared for those who were our neighbors or our close neighbors.
Yeah, and that's, so there's this, you know, collective wisdom that something happened in the mid to late 18th century, where the more, as one scholar put it, the moral imagination begins to widen. Mm-hmm. That it was no longer about your neighbor only, or about your village, or about the nascent nation or state, but increasingly it was about those who you've never met before. Yeah. They become part of your moral imaginary. And, the turning point in this, and really was the first, you know, one of the first instances of this kind of humanitarianism was with abolitionism. Mm-hmm. And, you know, especially in Britain, where people are being asked to think about the suffering of Africans. And, you know, if you take the historical perspective seriously, this is really not just a shift, but this is mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Because Britons who've never met dark-skinned people before and have very little awareness of who they are, and if they have an awareness, may think of them as inferior to themselves, all of a sudden begin to care about the enslaved.
Yeah.
And how to stop it, how to stop the Middle Passage, and then how to, you know, rid plantations from the British name. And this is really a phenomenal development. And it, you know, this is also part of a history of reform movements and the idea of creating new kinds of political order at home. But you begin to see that there's this really fundamental shift, though, in the moral imagination. And, you know, so, you know, one way to think about it is, whose suffering can we narrate, or whose mm-hmm. suffering do we choose to narrate?
Yeah.
And one of the things that's happened over the expansion of, you know, with globalization, with new kinds of transportation and visual connections, our narration of suffering is much more inclusive mm-hmm. Than it ever was. And so we begin to care about the suffering of those, you know, on the other side of the globe. And we actually then begin to think about whose suffering do we care about? One of the things that, you know, I think many know within humanitarianism is that when they sell or market humanitarianism, they almost always do with, you know, children.
Yeah.
Jeb knew that.
Yeah.
Children sell and women sell. Mm-hmm. But someone like us, we don't sell so well.
No.
You're not going to really find us. So, you know, it's not to say that no one cares about our suffering, but let's just say our suffering doesn't seem to matter as much as the suffering of others.
Yes.
And so you begin to have, you know, these are all very interesting bits of evidence of not only the universalization of suffering, but also still a kind of priority within whose suffering matters most.
And the abolitionist and the slavery trade was kind of highlighted. And then people also started to notice the kind of poverty in the East End of London and the poverty at home, didn't they? In the factories and in the different ways it was, and the mental health kind of movement. I'm from a Quaker background, and you see the kind of the areas that they moved in. Coming back to something you said about the kind of post or pre-ideological kind of humanitarianism, is there not a danger that that you get a sort of humanitarian technocratic governance, which I see kind of around the rhetoric of neutrality, but also sometimes humanitarian technocratic governance can actually undermine the local governance structure, local political kind of structures. Could you say something about that, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting question. And, you know, humanitarianism since the 1990s has changed in very much fundamental ways. It was a kind of pre-modern makeshift machinery that in which people sort of reinvented the wheel with every new emergency. And it was staffed sometimes by experts, but quite literally by volunteers who had a good heart, but often didn't know whether they were being effective or not, and just felt like, you know, having a good heart was enough. And then the 1990s came and, you know, humanitarianism went big time. You began to see an explosion of the field in terms of resources and staff and ambitions. And then it becomes, you know, you can't operate a makeshift machinery in this new age. And so people begin to tighten the ship for lots of very good reasons, as you can imagine. And part of that movement also introduces a more, I would say, you know, some of it's technocratic, but some of it is more about just establishing rules, codes of conduct, principles, so that you can standardize your responses and you're not making it up all the time. And hopefully you're standardizing responses that make things more effective as well. And, you know, you need experts for a lot of that stuff. And you begin to develop then, you know, and this is an important phase of it, you know, a growing movement away from amateurs and towards experts. And experts, you know, because they're experts, have superior knowledge. And so when, you know, recall the paternalism I spoke about earlier, you know, the experts, the new rise of technocrats, you know, are trained in many ways with, you know, superior with education and credentials, and are expected to have superior knowledge over, let's say, those who are untrained or local. And so for me, one of the interesting developments of humanitarianism in this new age is the role of experts. And that experts, by definition, almost always believe, and they're trained to believe, that they are better. And in many cases, they are. I don't want to have a fireman operate on me. I think that would probably not be a good mix. So there are reasons for the expertise, but, you know, it plays into one of these, you know, ongoing tensions in terms of governance, which is you can have demos, the rule of the people, and then you can have technocrats, which is the rule of the experts. And the one thing experts don't need is the rule of the people, because, right, they're untrained. And so democracy may not be as important for technocrats. And it maintains then, in the terms of this technocratic governance, it does maintain that inequality that I spoke about earlier between, let's say, the internationals and the locals. And so you find it disparaging in the, in these moments of, let's say, local knowledge, with the presumption that expert knowledge is superior to local knowledge. And so that, again, sort of disenfranchises local voices. You know, not only do they not know enough, but if you actually were to listen to them, you wouldn't really, you know, you wouldn't honor their answer, because it's not in their own best interest. So again, the technocrats are trying to do things that they believe are generally in the best interests of others. But what it does then is it disenfranchises those who would like to talk about how they see their interests.
And, you know, as a student of organizations and management and leadership, it strikes me, and like my critique of the humanitarian system since only being part of it for 6 months, but just listening to people, is this expertise and this technocratic expertise becomes distorted because managerialism takes on this idea that they're expert as well, and actually over bureaucratic, over kind of over engineered systems, over engineered processes, regulations, there comes a whole kind of a process which is wrapped up in modernity's thinking, and this modernity idea of kind of we must have growth, we must have efficiency, we must drive change, becomes kind of its own narrative, which actually shuts out other narratives. And it's talking to people, it seems that this kind of over centralization and over bureaucratization has come out of this expertise. You know, we have expert surgeons, but kind of this other kind of form has become a life of its own and taken over. And there's a big critique in the system of this.
Yeah, no, I think it's really interesting and trying to tease out the nuances, right, of technocracy. And, you know, and what you're posing, of course, is that it changes social relations. Mm-hmm. As we know, technology is not just a thing out there, but it also refigures how it is that we relate to each other. And, you know, to give in all kinds of interesting ways that are subtle, but nevertheless important. So, for instance, you know, what counts as data for, you know, this new form of technocratic humanitarian governance? And, you know, it's about quantification. It's about numerical data. And so anything that's going to try and provide evidence or persuasive evidence now has to come almost always in this kind of form.
Yeah.
Even if we don't understand it, right? It's still the smoke and mirrors. And what gets downgraded? Well, it used to be, and I'm not saying this is better, I'm saying it's just different. What used to be was, if you will, storytelling. Mm-hmm. You know, it was observational. It was people going out in the field and speaking to others and getting a sense of, you know, what the lay of the land was. And, mm-hmm. you know, that now has become de-emphasized.
Yeah.
It's now seen as cute or colorful, as opposed to evidence that we might be able to use. And so, you know, even the reasoning processes that people use and what they count as data also begins to change. Mm-hmm. And again, it's not, I'm not a Luddite. There's a really important role for quantification and numerical arguments. But it's to say, as you were suggesting, that one has shunted aside the other. And asking people, what have you lost?
Yes.
When you've done that, you know, what are we missing? And one of the important things that we're missing, of course, is we're missing the perspective from local populations.
Yeah.
That now we sit at 30,000 feet with our data that we crunch, and people become numbers.
Yeah.
And there's something fundamentally dehumanizing about this, especially for a sector like humanitarianism that sees itself as joined in a much more emotional and solidaristic relationship.
Yeah, and I call this control of numbers, this audit culture, this target culture. It's like you say, it shouldn't be kind of dismissed, because it's like, you know, the richer data can make massive differences to people's lives. You know, we need to get this stuff right. But there's, a massive distortion where people think about evidence-based as apolitical. Well, actually, it's usually very political. It's like people have interests. People kind of read numbers in different ways. The way you interpret numbers is very political. So the idea that it's scientific and neutral and also needs to be challenged. And that mix, I mean, I talk about a new age of humanitarianism. Like my understanding is to think more ecosystemically and get this idea of mutualism, where you actually have, you don't dismiss the numbers or the scientists or the expertise, nor do you dismiss the storytelling and the local knowledge and the on the ground understandings, that you have this kind of mutual engagement, and you think about kind of ecosystems rather than, I mean, one of the problems I've been thinking about is like this term localization. It's a very polarizing term. It's like localization good, center bad, and it's sort of you get this kind of bipolar splitting, you know, and it doesn't really take you far. You kind of, you go into camps and it gets stuck. So it's trying to think about ways to kind of undo that. And I do a lot of work on eco-leadership and ecosystems, and trying to think about ways of disrupting that those kind of polarized kind of arguments.
Yeah, no, and I, you know, I think that language of localization is coming out of at a particular moment. There have always been forms, I would say, of resistance to this model. And the other way I think about it is that it's not like those who are on the receiving end don't want compassion. They do want the goods, they want the services, they want the life-saving equipment, but in many ways they're saying, but lose the attitude.
Yes.
And so, you know, it's like someone who cares a little too much and consequently also thinks that maybe you don't even know what your best interests are. And so they ignore you. And we've all had that experience, and we all kind of, you know, get a little annoyed by it, at least a little annoyed. So I think of this as more as a form of resistance, against paternalism.
Yeah.
It's not only that it, if you will, rubs raw against our democratic and egalitarian sensibilities, but the further argument is that this kind of top-down approach isn't very effective.
Correct.
And for all of the, you know, concerns that humanitarians seem to have about effectiveness and worry that localization will undermine that effectiveness, as you probably know now, when you look at any evaluation of an emergency, it's failures.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like the humanitarians are necessarily doing a great job. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think part of the localization argument is not only is it closer to our normative ideals, but it's also better. And so, you know, there's a lot that's going around in terms of this localization. You can hear the anxiety of those of the internationals that they're going to lose power, not only lose power, but they're going to lose resources. There's a fear that maybe the local isn't better. I mean, I think that's sort of deeply embedded in the psyche of many internationals. And so there's a lot going on in terms of this localization debate. And it's in my own approach, my thinking about it is I try to avoid these binaries. Is it good or bad? But, you know, like we should be asking ourselves, is it good in which ways and why? Is it bad in which ways and why? And to provide a more, you know, closer to objective analysis. So I see myself as someone who's quite sympathetic to localization for all kinds of reasons. But nevertheless, you know, I think we always should avoid falling in love with our theories. Just not something we should be doing.
Yeah. And it's not, you know, in the work I do, it's not kind of either or. It's like you don't get away from hierarchical power. You can't go just to kind of lateral power. There's always a relationship between the two. There's always a negotiation. There's always going to be somebody more powerful or have more resources. So there's always a kind of a negotiation. The question is, how do you negotiate and how do you listen and how do you kind of learn? How do you kind of work together? How do you do it mutually rather than kind of as a salvation aid or as a controlling aid? How do you kind of make that shift?
Yeah. And, you know, the other side is, you know, when we get into this idea that we're going to shift from the international local so it'll be better because we've somehow removed power, you never remove power.
No.
Power is always there. And all you know, in many ways, then what happens is those who are the local leaders now have power over others. And years ago, I once attended a regional meeting of NGOs. This is in Southeast Asia. And they were mainly heads of some of the, you know, important regional humanitarian organizations. And it was fascinating. It was really interesting. And there was a lot of talk of what we would now call localization. This was pre-2016. And what's interesting is that at the very end of the conference, when they were saying, well, how should we improve what we're doing? Who should we invite next time? And somebody said, oh, maybe we should invite some victims to speak. Maybe we should have some members of the affected community. And I thought that was fascinating because then I looked around and went, yeah. You know, most of the people that are involved in a lot of these local aid organizations are themselves educated, coming from an elite class, and also see themselves as in some way superior to those who are coming in from the hills, you know, who are inferior. So you never get rid of it.
You don't get rid of power at all, and you have to kind of find ways to negotiate it and work it and listen in different ways. One thing
Add one thing here, though?
Yeah, go.
And I think this is actually where the conversation in humanitarianism has gotten better. Because when I started working on this, you know, in the 1990s, and I'm a political scientist, so I would talk about power. Mm-hmm. And there was a kind of allergic reaction to that language among humanitarians, that they didn't want to see themselves as possessing power. They like to see themselves as in a solidaristic relationship. Mm-hmm. And so I kept asking about power, and they kept pushing back. And, you know, that continued for a while. But I think one of the important evolutions is the sector now recognizes fully that power is involved in almost everything they do.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean they handle it well. Doesn't mean they know what to do with it. Doesn't mean they're comfortable. But at least they're willing to have a debate around the role of power in humanitarian aid. And that's an important development.
Yeah, no, I agree. I was in Poland recently working with Ukrainian refugees, NGOs working with Ukrainian refugees. And one thing I was really impressed by, I mean, firstly, you couldn't help but be impressed by the way kind of individuals create just startup kind of organizations to create creches, schools, like, it, you know, there's 1.5 million kind of Ukrainian refugees there. And you know, it kind of blew me away just as kind of the immense kind of energy and resources people kind of gathered and set up these kind of organizations. But what was really interesting as well was how nearly every one of these organizations, some would be kind of providing homes, some education, some creches, some psychological support. But they all had in their minds building civil society as a kind of secondary, like, you know, we must build civil society. We must kind of hold together. We mustn't kind of let the refugees sort of split the communities and stuff. And I wondered what you thought about that in the wider kind of, in, from your experience, this kind of idea of building civil society as part of the humanitarian kind of process.
Yeah, it's not, at least when you look at classical humanitarianism, that was not what it was about. It was really about saving lives. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you leave politics aside and you leave what happens after you save lives to somebody else. But, you know, there's always been this concern about relationships and what you leave behind. And I think what's interesting is that the data supports that there are a lot more than grassroots movements than grassroots humanitarianism than ever before. Mm-hmm. And we can explain that by new technologies, wealth, there are a lot of reasons why. But I think it also, you know, what people are also talking about, well, this is what the data suggests, is that, you know, the large organizations are pretty bureaucratic and scoliotic, and they don't really have the ability to accept volunteers. You know, this is a professional outfit.
Yeah.
And those who are able to jump in as volunteers find themselves kind of overwhelmed by the red tape, overwhelmed by the kind of hierarchy and the command and control. It seems to just sop the lifeblood out of you.
Yeah.
And so what you're finding is in these contexts is that this kind of do-it-yourself humanitarianism, grassroots humanitarianism, and some of it is because we have more, you know, study tours and you happen to, or you're traveling more and you do a little volunteer tourism and then you develop relationships. And a lot of them are very small. And I'm not saying small is beautiful. But I'm saying that there's, if you know, a different way of doing humanitarianism that isn't in these large behemoths, that rather are very much, you know, if you will, tap into the heartstrings and, you know, let people feel, let people feel connections. They have face-to-face relationships with local communities. It's not always mediated through, you know, paper. And then a lot of them that we've seen again from the data. They don't want to be big. For them, the large Save the Children's and the Oxfam's are, it's the negative model. We don't want to do that because we'll lose something. And so now these are difficult to maintain, mainly because you struggle for resources. But, you know, it's a different way of working. And people who are in this kind of grassroots mode also realize that the local is very much part of a bigger civil society. And what they want to do then is, and sometimes it's about finding the right leaders. Sometimes it is about making sure that there are connections. And it's a little more hands-on, which can cut both ways. And so, you know, the grassroots side, I think, is really interesting. And you know, the data I saw from the U.S. is that, you know, it's been increasing by about 50% a year.
That is interesting. And, you know, that was my experience of a tour of Poland was existing NGOs were kind of small NGOs were adapting and to this new war to situation very kind of fluidly and adaptively and doing amazing things. New ones were starting up. And there's this feeling of agency and like, you know, in the big organizations, you can feel disenchanted. You can feel kind of like disempowered. And there's this feeling of agency and engagement and you know, with the liberal order being questioned now and with the governments, the funding's been immense in the last 20, 30 years, but we think that's going to be changing. It looks like it's going to be kind of reducing in the future. The UK budget certainly kind of got reduced recently. So maybe this grassroots kind of ecosystemic kind of movement will mute this kind of way of working, will provide a new humanitarianism for the next age. What you're writing a book on the new age of humanitarianism, is that correct?
Yeah. So thanks for giving me the opportunity to plug it.
have you got any final, we're coming towards an end, have you got any final kind of thoughts on what that new age might look like? If it, kind of key core ideas?
Yeah, so I'm writing it with Uni Karankura, who is a former president of MSF International. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like you and, you know, like many others, there's a sense, you know, and I worry about trying to find new ages or new theories, you know, you know, and as I jokingly say, you know, my first age was really long. My second age was a little bit shorter. Now the third age is just a decade. And now I've got my fourth age. So, but I do think it's different. I think there's been a break. Mm-hmm. And some of the things we've been talking about are part of that break, particularly with the new managerialism, the corporatization of the sector. But there are other things that I found really quite stunning in terms of, you know, as we think about it in terms of three baskets, the first one being security, we do see some important changes. And over the last 20 years, part of it is what I call securitization. Well, you know, adopting it from another field in which, and humanitarianism has always had this kind of fluid relationship to security. It's always been somewhere, you know, because of its relationship to war, it's always had a very strong relationship to security. Yeah. But increasingly we find new constraints being imposed on humanitarians. A lot of it is from the war on terrorism, material support laws, questions of financing, you know, other kinds of counterterrorism policies, and they've really affected humanitarianism. There's also been, as you know, as you look at Europe and the United States, with the attempt to, let's say, securitize refugees as a threat. And if they're a threat, then the people who help them must be a threat.
Yeah.
And those are the aid agencies. And so we find new laws that criminalize humanitarianism. As you know, there are people who are on trial, have been in Italy and Greece. They're also on trial in the United States. But that's partly where the some of the securitization. And of course, there is an increase in the number of threats on aid workers.
Yes.
So those are all. The second basket is related to economics. And, you know, and this has probably been the most interesting change for me, just because I think it's more of a break than we've ever seen in humanitarianism. There's this, you know, broad cultural consensus among humanitarians that their world is different from the corporate world or the world of markets.
Yeah.
They're, and not just different, but, you know, humanitarianism is part of the sacred and the economic market-based world is part of the profane.
Yeah.
And there is that sense that you need to keep them separate, because if they get too close, we know what'll happen, which is that humanitarianism won't be the same thing. It'll be corrupted.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting developments that's taken place really over the last two decades, and it goes back to this more technocratic humanitarian governance, is that there's been not an there's not been just a detente, but there's also an etant. There's new kinds of partnerships and collaborations. And what in the 1990s would have been almost unthinkable is now a matter of standard practice.
Yeah.
And it's not just simply new partnerships. I'm sure, you know, well, I can tell you, you know, in terms of SAVE, and it's really quite stunning. I invite you and others to go take a look, which is that Save the Children has a partnership with the luxury jewelry brand Bulgari.
Yes.
And yeah, and it's really, you know, imagine that, a luxury, you know, and you might say this seems crass, or this seems like a blatant attempt to, you know, benefit from humanitarianism, and it is. And for some, this is, you know, blasphemous. For others, it's just the nature of the beast.
Yeah.
And if we can help more people, then so be it. And it's an interesting kind of development and set of new kinds of dilemmas that have been taking place. We also see, you know, and it plays into, you know, brand aid. Save the Children wants to promote its brand. So does Bulgari, so that both work together. There's new kinds of humanitarian financing, because if it's not coming from states, you got to think about corporations and market alternatives. It's had its most profound effect, I think, on technology. So yeah. One of the big developments in humanitarianism over the last 15 years is the use of cash assistance.
Yes.
Which are done through mobile technology, which were developed by financial institutions that join with like MasterCard, that join with aid agencies. So there are a lot of ways in which there's, you know, a change in the political economy.
Yeah. And then I guess the Gates Foundation and the Bill Gates kind of foundation is also part of that kind of shift, that you know, someone with a very commercial background comes in with a lot of money and kind of and disrupts kind of how aid is traditionally.
Yeah, no, that there are philanthropies, and, you know, and those who write about these things will call them they'll say it's philanthrocapitalism.
Yes.
Which is to, you know, recognize the extent to which they're not just providing aid, they're providing a lifestyle.
Yes.
They're promoting markets, they're promoting market-based solutions, which may not be bad, but then again, as we've seen with the vaccines for COVID, markets don't necessarily provide access.
That's right.
You know, markets simply provide access for those who can afford.
Mm-hmm.
And those who can't afford don't get access.
Yeah.
So those are some of the, and we spoke earlier about localization. And I think those are, you know, some of the securitization, marketization, and then these changes in the relationship between givers and receivers, you know, is in an age, we call it post, which is another way of saying we have no idea what it is. We know it's not like what was going on, but we don't know really what its elements are. And if I live long enough, I can write a book saying I was all wrong. It wasn't post. It was all one continuation.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
That sounds very, very interesting. I really look forward to reading it when it comes out, and I'll send you my recent thinking on what we've done, and see how that aligns. Michael, we're coming to the end. I ask all my guests a question at the end, based on your work and your life's experience. What does it take to live a good life and to create a good society? Just any reflections at all, and any thoughts for our listeners on what it means to live a good life and to create a good society?
Oh, I wish you'd warn me about this one.
Yeah, sorry.
You know, I think it's skepticism. You know, that's, and that comes in part from my academic training, where we're supposed to be skeptical. Mm-hmm. We're supposed to be skeptics to anything. So that any kinds of claims really are not truth. They're approximations.
Yeah.
And we try to get closer and closer, but we can never get there, which means that, you know, we're kind of, we should be curmudgeons. We should, you know, doubt ourselves. We should doubt what we hear. We should, you know, be skeptical. I mean, I think that's what a community of learning is all about.
Yes.
So, but it also is a good thing to take into our personal relationships.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good thing to take into our, you know, everyday relationships. And it is, you know, to, because it also then informs other things like listening.
Yes.
Yeah. Learning.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I think there, and it also can, you know, a kind of hospitality, openness, not to, just to new ideas, but to messengers that you may not have listened to before. So I think that skepticism leads to, I mean, this is kind of what Karl Popper said, it helps to breed an open society.
Yes. Yeah.
So yeah. That would, I guess that would be my.
Thank you very much. No, that's really good. I mean, sorry to drop that in on you, but sometimes this, a response from the top of the head is a very rich one, and you just get a very rich response. So we thank you, Michael. It's been a really lovely conversation, really enjoyable, and I look forward to reading your book. Thanks for sharing your thoughts.
Well, and please do send me anything you have. I love to read what you're doing.
Cool. Great stuff. Take care.